Kripal gave only this message, and even the wind also teaches us this. If you keep walking while doing the Simran, the destination comes to you by itself. This is Sanchi's Bhajan, Kripal Yahi Sandesh Deta, on page 203. The fort of deceit will be destroyed in this world because walls of sand do not last. There are so many sins with you, you are a great sinner. Hail the power of Almighty Kripal, who carries all the burden. No one is an enemy. No one belongs to anyone else. Everyone is your very own. For as the Gurbani teaches, all this world was created from one light. O Guru Kripal, the negative power trembles, and death also is nervous in front of whoever has caught hold of your finger. Ajayb says, apologize to Kripal if your soul wants happiness.
Kripal yahi sandesha deta hava yahi sikalati hai simran karte chale chaloto manjil kud mil jati hai. Kripal yahi sandesha deta hava yahi sikalati hai simran karte chale chaloto manjil kud mil jati hai. Chal farb ke kile ek dina duniya mein de jate hai. Chal farb ke kile ek dina duniya mein de jate hai. Reton ki deewar der tak kabhi nahi tik pati hai. Reton ki deewar der tak kabhi nahi tik pati hai. Simran karte chale chalo to manjil kud mil jati hai. Kripal yahi sandesha deta hava yahi sikalati hai. Simran karte chale chalo to manjil kud mil jati hai. Itne sare paap saath mein, itne sare paapi hai. Itne sare paap saath mein, itne sare paapi hai. Kripal taakat teri je ho sab ka baad uthati hai. Kripal taakat teri je ho sab ka baad uthati hai. Simran karte chale chalo to manjil kud mil jati hai. Kripal yahi sandesha deta hava yahi sikalati hai. Simran karte chale chalo to manjil kud mil jati hai. Na koi veri nahi begana, jo bhi hai sab apna hai. Na koi veri nahi begana, jo bhi hai sab apna hai, ek noor se sab jag upajo, gurbani batlati hai. Ek noor se sab jag upajo, gurbani batlati hai. Simran karte chale chalo to, manjil kud mil jati hai. Kirpal yahi sandesha deta, hava yahi sikalati hai. Simran karte chale chalo to, manjil kud mil jati hai. Guru kirpal tumari undali, tam rakhi hai jisne bhi. Guru kirpal tumari undali, tam rakhi hai jisne bhi. Usake aga kal kapta, aur mot ghabrati hai. Ajaib kirpal to mangala mafi, ajaib kirpal to mangala mafi. Jejindari sukachati hai, simran karte chale chalo to, manjil kud mil chati hai. Kirpal yahi sandesha deta, hava yahi sikalati hai. Simran karte chale chalo to, manjil kud mil jati hai.
No one is an enemy. No one belongs to anyone else. Everyone is your very own. For as the Gurbani teaches, all this world was created from one light. Kripal gave only this message, and even the wind also teaches us this. If you keep walking while doing the Simran, the destination comes to you by itself.
Okay. Well, it's very nice to be with you all, even though I'm not with you physically. Still, it gives me a very good feeling to know that I'm at, one way or another, I'm at Satsang Hall at Sampani Ashram. Of course, we're remembering the great, great Master Kripal Singh. And I wanted to read or recite or whatever some stories. When I was first with him, and also when I was last with him physically. The first bunch is from right after he founded Sampani Ashram, and it begins the day after we left Sampani Ashram, and we were in Vermont. And I had led the caravan between the ashrams, New Hampshire and Vermont, because I supposedly knew the territory. So the day after we got there, we were at Vermont just like we were in New Hampshire, 24 hours. We got there about noon and we left the following day. And we went down to the Baron von Blomberg's house in Hampton, New Hampshire. The Baron was Master's point man for the World Fellowship of Religions. And the next few weeks actually, were devoted to the World Fellowship of Religions. And the Baron took the Master all over the place to different houses of wealthy people, influential people, people that he wanted to involve in the WFR. And so we went down to the Baron's house in Hampton, New Hampshire. I was leading the way again. We came into Barrie, Vermont, and I made a wrong turn on Route 14 and went north instead of south. I didn't realize what I was doing, and I was driving along very happily until somebody beeped a horn behind me. I turned, and this car from the rear of the caravan had caught up to me, and the guy hollered out, "I think you're going the wrong way." Oh, my God. As soon as he said it, I realized it had happened. I was overwhelmed with remorse. It may seem like a very small, dumb thing, but I was leading the master. It was a chance to do things right, and here I was goofing him up. I just felt so small. So I turned the truck around and drove back, but I felt increasingly dumb that I was the leader. I felt like anyone could do a better job than me. As we drove along, I was feeling bad all the way down. We got to Boscawen, New Hampshire, where there was a Howard Johnson's in those days, and the caravan stopped and we all went in to eat. Master went in too. He was much more, I would say, he was infinitely more accessible during that tour than in 1972. He would often go into restaurants and sit down with us at the table, although he seldom ate much. So he was in there about 10 minutes and then he went out. I realized he was gone and I really wanted to apologize. So I went outside and saw him way at the other end of the lot all by himself, pacing back and forth. When I walked up to him, he was quite lost in thought. I said, "Master, you know, I'm really very sorry that I feel so badly up there." He looked at me in total incomprehension. "What?" I said, "I'm really sorry. I took a wrong turn and I led the whole caravan out of the way and I delayed you and I'm just very sorry." He looked at me absolutely blankly for about 10 seconds. And then the most beautiful light broke over his face in a dazzling smile. And he said, "Oh, that's all right." And he turned around and kept on pacing. I realized that he had totally forgotten and forgiven. It was my first experience of Master's forgiveness, but by no means the last. It was a small thing that was a huge thing to me. The next few days he was with the Baron and we didn't know what he was doing or where he was. Our memories of the preceding week were very much with us and unlike any memories we had ever had before. Then we got a phone call. The Master would be speaking that night in Jackson, New Hampshire, which is in the White Mountains about 70 miles north of the ashram. There was a forest fire in Sanrenton that afternoon. 1963 was the first year of a three-year drought, which greatly increased the fire danger, which I felt obligated to help fight. But with the grace of God, we got it under control by late afternoon, and five or six of us went up. The Master spoke in the Congregational Church to the townspeople. When we walked into the church, he saw us come in and greeted us from the pulpit. When he had finished speaking, he came out on the sidewalk and joined us, the group of us from Saint Bonnie. He stood in the middle while we formed a circle around him, and he asked us how we were doing like old friends. He had just met us a few days before, but the thing is, the church was full of important aristocratic people, and we were a bunch of nothings. And he was talking to us. We couldn't believe it. Frank and Eleanor Irwin were there, and they wanted to get initiated, a couple in their 60s, and he was talking to them about that. He apologized because he couldn't do it himself. He just didn't have time, he said. He said Prendergast can do it. It's the same power. Judith and I had to go back, but some of the people, including Frank and Eleanor, decided to stay overnight up there in a cabin and see him the next morning too. So the day after we had gone up to Jackson, I was walking around the ashram. I was just feeling so, Master had just been there. The house was still full of him. I went up to his room and it was radiating Master all over. I wanted to see him so badly and I thought everything had ended. I was wandering around the place up by the rock where he had sat, and I was just wishing he'd come. And the cars started driving up the road. Only Master wasn't with them, but everybody else was there. Mr. Connor was there, and Eileen Wigg, and Frank and Eleanor. Frank grabbed me by the front door of the big house and said, wiping sweat off his face, he was so excited, "I'm telling you, I never saw anything like it. The man's a saint, I don't mind telling you, it's absolutely true." When I was able to piece it all together, this is what I found out. The Master, along with the Baron, Taiji, and Cuckoo, had stayed at a castle in the town, a real castle. This was a wealthy community, and the castle, built in imitation of European ones, belonged to a countess who the Baron was approaching on behalf of the World Fellowship of Religions. The next morning, the satsangis, including Frank and Eleanor, Mr. Kana, and others, had gone over to see him. But when they knocked at the front gate, the maid refused to let them in. They didn't know what to do. Master was inside and they couldn't get to him. She wouldn't even let them stay on the property. They had to go outside the fence and the gate was shut behind them. Frank said the Master came out of that castle, walked over to them, and climbed the fence to get to them. He stood there on the outside of the fence and talked with them for half an hour or so, and then went back in. Cuckoo told me afterwards that she had said to him, "Well, if you speak to the maid, you can work it so they can come in." But Master said, "No, there's a Punjabi proverb that says, if you don't want someone to be treated badly, then don't put him in a place where he's going to be treated badly. Why should my people have to put up with that sort of thing? I'll go to them." So he did. Now, Frank had been coming, as I noted above earlier in the book, to satsang from the beginning. He was the guy interested in Zen who was very skeptical about bhakti yoga, which is how he understood the path. But he had been waiting for Tsadbani, for the Master, to come. And when he saw him walking up the path to the big house, he commented to me that he seemed to be pure spirituality. He and Eleanor were initiated a month later. Millie Prendergast did come up from Boston and put them on the path. Well, everybody, the Master's party, minus the Master and a few others, all piled in, and Mr. Khanna held satsang, and we ate. Then Mr. Khanna said to me, "We need another vehicle to carry luggage because we're losing a car. You have a nice truck. Would you like to carry luggage down to Connecticut for us? I'll cover all your expenses, and as soon as we can make other arrangements, you can come back." Would I like to? They couldn't hold me back. I was in the cab of the truck before anything could be done. Now, at that point, we had no money at all. We were flat broke because we had spent everything fixing up the house for the Master. And I, of course, had lost my job. My truck, a 1950 GMC pickup, was a crummy old green thing. It looked kind of sick and it was old and rattly. We piled up the luggage in it and I got in, and Eileen Wigg rode with me down to Connecticut. I went down, leaving Judith and the kids, wearing the work clothes I had on with a half-grown beard that I had started a few weeks before. I was in Connecticut driving that truck around mansions and rich people's houses for 5 days. The following is taken from a talk I gave a few years later. We met the Master and the others in Waterbury, and we drove from there to Greenwich. The Baron was driving the Master via the Merritt Parkway, beautiful road that is closed to trucks. When we reached the entrance to the parkway, the Baron stopped the car in which he was driving the Master, which meant we all stopped. The Baron got out and he walked over to my pickup, which at that point contained Betty Shiflett and me, and said, "You know, you can't take the truck on the parkway." I said, "I know, it's all right. I just won't go on the parkway. I'll go another way. Don't worry. It's all right. You go on." He went back and got in the car. I looked up ahead and saw him talking to the Master. He finally got out and, looking very sad, came back and stood there. He said, "The Master says he won't go on the parkway if you can't go on the parkway." I was so moved at the Master's concern for me in that truck that I just couldn't bear to think that he would go even 15 minutes out of the way for my sake. I said, "Oh no, please, please, just drive him on the parkway. I'll go the other way. Please don't make him delay on my account. I backed the truck around and drove off to Greenwich another way. When people talk about the master's love, I'll tell you that it's the realest of the realest of the real, and it comes out in the tiniest possible things. You just can't fathom it. We went to a house owned by some Jordanians where the mayor of Bethlehem was staying. Bethlehem was at that time in Jordan. The baron, who had been a friend of the old king of Jordan, Abdullah, knew the family. These people were Muslims and they were interested in the World Fellowship of Religions. They were not initiates. So we all got invited in. I'll tell you how that happened. This is a funny story. The baron comes out like a villain, but really he just wanted things to be right. And I didn't mean any harm. I was just down there doing the job that I'd been asked to do there. Naturally, I wanted to be around. I was at that time about 28. I was still a pretty young kid for my age in a lot of ways, but I just wanted to be with the master. There were others too. The baron didn't like lots of satsangis following the master around when he took him to these rich people's houses. So he was very good at losing us. If we were following him and he'd come up to a light, he had an interesting way of getting to it just as the light was turning red, and he'd go through and we stayed. But I would follow him through anyway. I pretended there was a chain in his car hooked to my bumper and it couldn't stop. So we got to this house. Two other carloads of satsangis had somehow gotten there ahead of him, and the people in the house were very gracious and had invited them all in. When he got there, they were all inside. I wasn't planning to go in. I was carrying the luggage and I waited in the truck. I just felt if they don't want me in, I don't have to go in. So Mr. Connor came out and hollered at me, "Come on in." So I went in. Everybody else was there. Taiji saw me. She said, "Sit on the floor, Russell." She wanted to make sure I knew my place. It was full of socialites, you see. Really rich people were there. They had no more idea what the master was than a man in the moon. You should have seen him. He was sitting there with them just as if they were his children. It didn't faze him a bit. One man was talking to him about lion taming, and Master was laughing. The man who owned the house had a really profound face. I noticed the way he looked at the Master. He knew nothing about him. He didn't know he was a saint. They knew he was active in the World Fellowship of Religions, that he was an important man, but they didn't know he was a saint or anything. Then this man said out of the blue to the Master, "You have the face of a prophet, sir. You have the face of a saint. Will you favor us with a discourse?" And the master got right up and spoke for 10 minutes about the inner teachings. It was beautiful. The atmosphere was crackling. It was electric. I was sitting there enthralled. He was standing and smiling. He said, "You've got to go inside." And he talked about the light, the sound current, the God into expression power, the full thing. He held nothing back. Tremendous power was flowing forth from him into that room. These people were sitting there, and I don't think they'd ever had an experience like it in their life. When he sat down, the old man that had asked him, the host, was rocking back and forth in ecstasy. He was hugging his knees. The grin on his face was so wide it was touching his ears. When Master was through, the man said, "Thank you. Thank you so much." He was so happy. The hospitality and reverence for guests, including me, that this Muslim family demonstrated were beyond anything I had experienced in my life up to that point. "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself," indeed. It was a lesson for me. When I got back to New Hampshire, I discovered the kids at my parents' house and Judith gone. Impatient at my prolonged absence and missing the master very much, she had driven to Rochester, New York, to see him at his next public stop. When she returned, we made plans to go to Toronto and arrived late at night, almost penniless, to have Master greet us so warmly, again as if we were old friends. We loved it there, especially the radiantly beautiful wedding of Stanley Sheinrock and Edna Robinson, where the bright movie lights illuminated his incredible face. so that every line seemed etched in acid, and where he blessed our marriage and told us that we were two bodies with one soul. We even loved the initiation there, where a Salvation Army band played outside the window during the sound current practice. We were able to join him next in Louisville, and this time we took the kids with us. At the motel in Louisville where we stayed, the master stuck his head in the window of our Corvair sedan, saw the mattress we had in lieu of our back seat, so that the children could play or sleep as they wished, and chuckled about our traveling home. In Louisville, we said goodbye to him, but what we were sure was the last time, because our money, including $500, which we had raised by selling a carpet Judith had inherited, had finally run out and the future looked bleak. That afternoon, I had a private interview with him. He was sitting cross-legged and his smile was dazzling. "Well," he said first thing, "when are you going back to that very sweet place?" I told him we were leaving early the next morning. He nodded and asked me if I needed any money. I was taken by surprise. I did, of course, but the thought of taking money from my master did not appeal to me, and I said no. This was the first time the master had offered me money, but was not to be the last. Eventually, I learned how to respond more appropriately. That night, the master gave a stunning farewell talk in Louisville, and among other things, said the following. "You know that Christ once said to his disciples, 'I don't want to make you slaves, but friends.' Slaves do not know what a friend can be. Slaves only know how to do what is said. You can appreciate anyone if you work along with him and see what he is doing. So Christ said, 'I make you my friends.' I think it is better that I address you as friends, because I have told you many times that I am a man like you, with the same privileges that you have got from God. But I have developed in a certain way you have not. And that development is due to the grace of God, or the God working through my master. That is how to die while alive, how to be reborn, how to be cut off from the attachments of the world, the body, and other things. That is a way within you already. So I love you as friends, I would say. I regard you as the children of light. Because I love God and that light is everywhere, so I have to love you and have regard for you as well." That night, the master was leaving Louisville for Minneapolis by train. I went to the station to see him off. The last time, for all I knew, that I might ever see him. In prospect, I had felt sad. These weeks with him had been the happiest I had ever known. But when we were actually at the station, standing on the steps of the train seconds before it pulled away, I felt such intense happiness at being with him again that all I could do was laugh. The joy of being with him in the present was stronger than the sorrow of leaving him in the future. At other times when I left him, the sorrow would take over after the parting had happened. This time, the joy remained and settled into a sort of blissful calm. Maybe something in me knew that I was going to see him again, and in a very short time, too. Whether I knew it or not, that is exactly what happened. Judith's parents chose that time to make over to her some money they had been holding for her in trust. And just 3 weeks after the farewell in Louisville, we were on our way to California, our debts paid and our hopes high. We planned to stay with him for the rest of the tour, if he didn't mind. Now I want to jump ahead 11 years. I'm now 39, approaching 40. And we have been at the Unity of Man Conference in February 1974. and the conference is just about over. Begins, I want to begin with the final day of the conference was the master's birthday, and an early morning session, 5:30 a.m., was scheduled to celebrate it. While the master said not a word in English during the whole session, it remains in my memory as the most powerful and charged satsang I've ever attended. Master had never been more beautiful. Sick, exhausted, 80 years old, he radiated love and easy good humor, deferred constantly to Yogi Bhajan, half his age, refused to give a proper discourse or to speak in English or to give out prasad, all of which was expected by various members of the audience. Instead, he conducted what looked like a good-humored private conversation that just happened to go out over the microphone with Yogi Bhajan and Pir Vilayat Khan in Hindi, then asked the yogi to translate for him. At the end, rather than giving out prasad, he requested Yogi Bhajan to give it out and himself took the first prasad from the yogi's hands. A gesture of humility that was astonishing under the circumstances. The tent, after all, contained 50,000 persons. Actually, there were, I think that's an error, I wrote it, but I think that there were closer to 5,000 persons because this was a small tent. It was not the main tent. And of course, many of the people who were attending the conference were not initiates, and the people at this satsang were all initiates. But there were at least 5,000 people there who were disciples of Kripal Singh, who were there to celebrate Kripal Singh's birthday and who wanted Kripal Singh's prasad. All in all, a very interesting morning. After the conference was over and I had returned home, what stayed with me most strongly was gratitude for the personal grace that the master had given me by allowing me to see him privately so often when he was so terribly busy and there were so many others pressing on his time. Night after night, I would find myself at his feet in his living room with very few people or sometimes alone, with little or no effort on my part. On one occasion when I was sitting on the floor at his feet and we were alone, he said out of the silence, "You should make the pond bigger." This was a surprise. I had to think very hard to remember that his last words to me as he was leaving Santpani Ashram in 1972 were, "Develop the pond more, please." He was referring to the pond which we had dug at the ashram and which we were standing next to at that moment. Other people had also heard him say that, and it had been recorded on tape. But because of the expense and difficulty involved in pumping the pond dry and getting the bulldozers in again, I had chosen to interpret his remarks as meaning that we should beautify the land around the pond, make it more suitable for meditation. In retrospect, it seems like a real cop-out on my part, but I convinced myself that that was what he meant and then forgotten about it. Now he was being very specific. "You should make the pond bigger." I stupidly asked, "You want us to make the pond bigger, Master?" He nodded, "Bigger and deeper. Who knows? You might find a spring." I promised him that we would do it as soon as feasible. And the following August, when he left the body, the work was just beginning. And while I was in India in connection with his passing, Judith wrote me that the bulldozer had just uncovered a spring. The conference ended that day, the master's birthday, and though I was asked to address it, the brief talk I gave was not nearly as satisfying as the panel had been. I explained earlier that I've been part of one of the panel sessions on world religions, and it had been an extremely uplifting experience for me in many, many ways. By this time, I was getting sick. The weather was cold, and many of the Western disciples were coming down with one thing or another. Dr. Richard Cardozo, a heart surgeon from New Hampshire and a good friend, was treating a line of 20 to 30 people every morning, and I was feeling miserable. Headache, cold symptoms, exhaustion, you name it. This may well have colored the almost disastrous series of mistakes I made in the following days. These, of course, were the last few days I ever spent with him on the physical plane, although I didn't know what he did. During those days, it so happened that I was often in the position of having made up my mind and decided something, and then discovered that everything was entirely different. The following is adapted from a talk I gave a year later, reminiscing about the conference. At the satsang after the conference was over, one of the conveners announced that there would be a meeting right after the satsang of the following people. And he read off a list of names, which included mine, and we were all supposed to come and attend. We were going to discuss things about how to carry on the work. But I didn't want to go to that meeting in the worst way. I was tired. I was sick. I had just been to satsang and I wanted to go to my room and meditate. I did not want to go to the meeting. But I felt, well, Master said it was my job to be here. If my name was called, I have an obligation, I'd better go. So very reluctantly I went, very reluctantly. I went in and Mr. Srivastava was there and Mr. Sareen, and they motioned me to a chair near them, which happened to be near the head of the table. I sat down, but I was very disgruntled. The meeting began. It was back and forth and people's opinions, and my headache got worse. All that stuff gives me a terrible headache, and I didn't say anything. I just don't feel I've got the strength to push through that wall of constant verbiage. So I listened, and this man had this opinion, and that man had that opinion. All of a sudden, the master came in. No one was expecting him. When I realized he was there, I turned around. It was like the sun had just come out on a gray day. He was standing there in the room, and it seemed like he was 10 feet high and too tall for the ceiling. He came in and took a chair, the chair next to me. He was 6 inches away from me at this meeting that I hadn't even wanted to attend. He was so close, it was like I couldn't see anything. The light was so dazzling. He pulled up his chair to the table and took part in the meeting. I had to move my chair over to make room for him. He squeezed in between Mr. Srivastava and me and sat there, and I had marvelous darshan for at least half an hour. Everything, not only that, the whole feeling of the room, everything that happened at the meeting, went shooting up 10 degrees. All of a sudden, the verbosity stopped. All the opinions, all the ego play that was going on just vanished, and we got right down to essences. There was no fooling around. And there were a lot of things that were like that. One night I had failed very badly. I was feeling very self-important, and Michael Grayson asked me something, and some of the things I said he didn't like, and he let me know it. And I lost my temper at him. I really got angry, and I told him off. And then I went right over to Master's house, because I had to go over to look at pictures for Satsang Desh. I didn't expect to see Master, but I went over carrying this thing that I had lost my temper, had violated the sanctity of the ashram. Only I wasn't thinking of it in those terms yet. I was still feeling self-important and complacent. It hadn't fully dawned on me what I had done. So I went over to Master's house and I went into the reception room, and Master was there. He was giving darshan. So I sat down in a far corner, and he saw me and called me up. He made me sit about 2 feet in front of him, and I never in my life experienced such love from him as he gave me that night. He said, "Thank God you have come." I was sitting there, and he was beaming this love at me. He asked me when I was leaving, and I said, "Wednesday night." This was Sunday night. He said, "You should stay 3 days longer." "Oh, I can't, Master. I have too many things to do. People expecting me this and that." He laughed and said, "That's all right." And then he said, "What are you going to write about the conference?" So I told him some of the things I had thought of. He said, "You had better write it here while it's still fresh in your mind. When you get home, it'll be stale." And I said, "Oh, no, Master. I always write better back there. He said, all right. You know, he continued to love me, even though I had gone over there with the weight of the anger and loss of temper hanging over me, and then I had twice argued with him. He had told me two very specific things, and I had said no. So I went back to my room. My stomach was upset. I couldn't sleep all night. I sat there in bed trying to sleep, and the events of the evening were going around and around in my head. Suddenly, I began to see things. First of all, that I had sinned very badly. I had lost my temper. I had gone to Master with that on my head. And what had he given me? Total forgiveness. Absolute love. Don't think for one minute that he can't see what a person has done. He can. I've had experience with that 100 times over. He knew exactly what I had done, but he gave me love anyway. Then he had given me 2 specific commandments. For all my talk about obeying the Master 100%, I had done what any idiot could have done and said no. So all that was going around in my head, and I spent the whole night in meditation. I couldn't sleep. It was no virtue on my part. So I sat 6 or 7 hours that night. I couldn't wait for the morning to come. I was going to put everything right. First thing I did, I found Michael, at whom I had gotten angry, and dragged him over to that same room where I had lost my temper because the same people were there. And I apologized to him and begged his forgiveness. He forgave me totally. He said, fine, didn't care in the least, excellent. So that was one thing. Then I went running over to Master's house. I said, Master, I want to stay longer. You told me to last night. Did you really mean that? I was thinking that you were just being polite. He said, no, no, it's up to you. You know better. Whatever you want, no imposition. If you can stay 1 or 2 days more, might be good, but it's for you to say. I want to do what you want, Master. He laughed, and I said, I'll write the article here. He said, no, no, you know better, whatever you think. I said, no, Master, you know better. And I went down to the ticket office that day, and the only flight I could get was exactly 3 days later than the one I had had. When I got back that night, Master said, are you going to write the article here or there? I said, here, Master. He said, good, then you'll have to stay longer. So I knew it was the real thing. Well, in those 3 days, I did write the article, and I gave it to him to read, and he read it and told me he liked it, which was a very sweet thing for me. And many things happened that made it a good thing that I stayed that long. But I didn't want to, you see. This is an important thing, the way Master works with all of us on every level. He does not impose. When we become disciples of a real Master, we don't become slaves. He is not a dictator or a tyrant. He gently points out to us what would be for our own good. If we take it, okay. If we don't, well, he never says, bad person, you'll have to pay for this. He never talks like that. He says, no, no, you know better. It's all right, no imposition, whatever you want. He talks like that. He leaves it up to us. It's because of the inherent dignity of the human being, I would say, that he acts this way. Because as he has said, quoting Jesus, I have come not to make slaves of you, but to make friends of you. On the last day of my stay, Reno Serene had an interview scheduled with the Master. And Reno, knowing it was my last day, very kindly asked me if I would like to come with him. I didn't say much during this interview, but Reno talked with the Master about a certain very sticky situation involving 2 satsangi married couples, the husband of one and the wife of the other having fallen in love. He had recently left New Hampshire and moved to California, and Reno was very aware of them. He asked the Master if he would intervene on the inner planes. The Master said no. Maulana Rumi says that God himself cannot change a man who does not want to change. Those were among the last words that I ever heard Master say, and I have never forgotten them. That night I was feeling sad and depressed over leaving, even though he had given me another hour and had teased and joked with me and allowed me to sit there while people came and went. I didn't feel the deep, intense grief that I had felt in the past on leaving him. Felt instead a dull depression, like a toothache, and a feeling of wanting more. As we said goodbye to him for the last time, about 16 persons were leaving that night, including several group leaders. Jim Russell and I were at the end of the line as we filed past him at the door. When we reached him, he put out his arm and stopped us from continuing and made us sit down again. He heaped prasad on us, bags and bags of sugar candy, and gave us the sweetest goodbye imaginable. When we got up to go, I felt happy and fulfilled and very, very grateful. It was the last gift he gave me, as Kripal Singh. 6 months later, on August 21st, 1974, we all received word that he had died. It was the end of our world as we had known it. And I want to read also another incident or story taken about, which happened about a year before the conference, a year before what I just read, when I was with him in 1973. And I talk about the difference between Kal and Dayal, which has a bearing on the story, so I'm going to read that. The masters of Shabda Yoga, when they're talking about God, distinguish sharply between Kal and Dayal. Kal, time, or Dharamrai, the Lord of Judgment, is the negative power, the Lord of the three worlds. He is the embodiment of power and control. Through his imposition of the law of karma and all its rewards and punishments, he keeps the jivas, or bound souls, going round and round in the cycle of transmigration. According to the masters, he is not evil, even though the Christian understanding of Satan is kind of a caricature of him. He is absolutely fair and just, giving to each soul exactly what it deserves. He was originally a part of God, one of the 16 sons of transcendent qualities that God separated himself into, which made the creation possible. The quality of time, judgment, limitation, when separated from the whole, was not able to stand by itself and fell disastrously from the point of view of the lower universe. Dayal, on the other hand, is mercy, the positive power. He is the God who loves us because we exist, and whom we love in the innermost part of our being, and who comes down into the three worlds, into the realms of power, as a still small voice, the embodiment of forgiveness and love. Our Parakletos, our advocate or defense attorney, as Jesus puts it, not our judge. He takes our part in opposition to the judge prosecutor, who is Kal. He is our advocate. That is why the masters have consistently maintained that they have not come to make us slaves, but friends. They are the embodiments of Dayal, not Kal. The true God manifests as the loving owner of the still small voice, because that is his nature. That is who he is. And if we understand this, it can explain a very great deal about the ways the masters work when they come among us. Of course, it also has to do with the nature of growth and the way in which we become more capable of receiving and assimilating that which the masters want to give us. Growth has to come from within ourselves. Our master can show us the way by example and precept, but he can't order us or compel us to grow. We have to handle that ourselves. That is why the master, like the God of love and mercy that he is the representative and embodiment of, is not a dictator, but an example and a guide. Dictators and those who exercise power and compel others to do this or that, whether they are called spiritual masters or whatever, show by their fruits that they are representatives and embodiments of the Lord of Judgment, and we can decide for ourselves whom we wish to follow. I saw many instances of this unwillingness to order his disciples around, and heard of many more in my time with Kripal. I have mentioned some of them in the course of the narrative, but one I haven't mentioned seems worthy of consideration. During my visit in September 1973, I learned that one of Kripal's oldest American disciples had published a pamphlet claiming that he had reached Sach Khand and was now a master, and that he had done this without getting the permission of the master first. He claimed that he had authority from within. It so happened that Kripal, night after night, after the group darshans were over, called three of us, Bob Radin, a newscaster for the Voice of America, Wolfgang Springer, a young man from Washington, whom I knew well and who was close to the disciple who had authored the pamphlet, and myself, and discussed with us all manner of ramifications of how this kind of thing could happen, why it might happen, and how to deal with it if it did happen. He mentioned the case of Paul Twitchell, who had taken initiation from Kripal in 1955, gone on to write the book Tiger's Fang about his inner experiences, and when the master refused permission to publish that book, changed the names of Kripal and other spiritual personages and published it anyway, after which he founded the Ek Onkar movement and became a multimillionaire while denying that he had any connection with Kripal, whatever. The master said that he had taken Twitchell up and shown him a few inner things, and that Twitchell's ego had run away with it and assumed that he had achieved all that there was to achieve, and that the same thing was happening here. I was reminded of what he had told me back in 1965, when the yogi who obviously had power had lost his temper and erupted all over the master's tea party, that ego is the last thing to go, and what we achieve before ego goes strengthens it. Ego, of course, the sense of I-hood, which the Buddha pointed out long ago doesn't really exist, and which Kripal often referred to as the fake ego, is the ultimate trap of the negative power, the Kal. It is what he uses to build the entire structure we call karma, the whole ultimately unreal paraphernalia of microscopically calibrated rewards and punishments that we are enmeshed in. But as long as we think it exists, we are caught. Thus, the feeling I am spiritually advanced can be the most dangerous stumbling block of all. That is why Baba Sawan Singh wrote in precisely this context, humility is the armor of the saints and their devotees. Anyway, I found those extra darshan sessions for the three of us extremely precious, and I did my best to assimilate and digest the things he was saying. But there was an extremely interesting sequel. On the last day of my stay, someone came to my room and told me the master wanted to see me. I was overjoyed to hear it and went bounding over to his house. He was not in the downstairs part where he usually received guests and gave darshan. He was upstairs in his own room, a simple cement room with a rope bed and nothing more. He was sitting on the floor surrounded by secretaries. He was working on correspondence. I knew that his procedure usually was to dictate the general content of a letter to one secretary, then to proceed to another letter and another secretary. When the first secretary had a rough draft ready, he would go over it, make any corrections he wanted to, and okay a final draft and so forth. His correspondence at this point was tremendous, and there were at least seven or eight secretaries in the room, maybe more, all working simultaneously on letter after letter. When I came in, everything stopped, and the master handed me a letter. "What is your opinion of this letter?" I looked at him and I looked at the letter. It was a letter from him to the disciple in question, the one who had authored the pamphlets. "My opinion, master? You want my opinion?" "Yes, yes, read the letter and tell me what you think of it." I looked around the room. Everyone was looking at me, waiting for my reaction. What on earth was going on? Well, I read the letter. It was a remarkable document. One page, single spaced, four paragraphs, as I recall. The first three paragraphs were a straightforward description of the difficulties and troubles ahead for him if he continued on the course he was following, and which made plain that the master wished him to stop. The final paragraph very lovingly gave him permission to do whatever he wanted to do. I looked up at the master. I reflected that he undoubtedly wanted me to be honest, although I was thoroughly confused as to why I was there and what my opinion was going to accomplish. So I said, "Well, Master, I think that if you send a letter like this, that he will just go by the last paragraph and do what he wants." There was an audible reaction, "Aha," from the secretaries, who obviously had expressed the same opinion. But the master took the letter back, read it over again, then said to me, "You mean to say that he will pay attention only to the last paragraph and ignore the others?" I said, "Yes, Master, that's what I think." He threw the letter to one of the secretaries and said, "Let him then." And that was it. I was dismissed and went back to my room. I pondered this incident long and hard, and several things became clear to me as time went by. First, that objectively speaking, my opinion was worthless. It was brought in only to teach both the secretaries and myself something very basic about the way the master operates. Second, what is that way? It is his responsibility to make the facts and implications of any course of action known beyond any doubt, but then it is our responsibility to act on it. We have his permission to be idiots, if that is what we want. Growth comes only when we recognize the applicability of what he is pointing out to our own situation. If we don't recognize it, but do what we are ordered to only because we are ordered to, we may gain something, but we don't grow, which is why the master does not usually put us in that position. Of course, all these things are points made by someone who is looking from the bottom upward, to someone like the master who is looking from the top down. A whole different set of constructs apply. But the fact remains that the master is not a judge, he is an advocate. He comes into the world of karma, of reward and punishment, of time and limitation and definition, Maya, as a still small voice working in opposition to all the fundamental assumptions of that world, to demonstrate that love is indeed the core of the universe, as Rabia put it, and drowns out judgment, punishment, and revenge every time. And just a couple of words more from his book, Master Kripal's Great Book on Prayer. Once the contact with Nam is established, the sadhak always feels the presence of the higher power, and the power remains forever with him wherever he may be, on the snowy mountain tops or in the burning desert sands. Reveling in the greatness of that power, he leaves all his cares to him and becomes indifferent to everything around him. He cheerfully accepts whatever comes his way as coming from him for his benefit alone. He consciously sees the divine will at work and smilingly surrenders himself to it with words of genuine gratitude on his lips. He has no longer any wishes and desires of his own, except what may be of God. Now he works as a mere instrument, moving like an automaton under the influence of that power. He sees all creatures, high and low, just as tiny specks set in an orderly harmony in the immense universe surrounding him. He now divines a procession which is orderly, an order which is harmonious, obeying a will infinitely above him and yet infinitesimally careful of him. In this way is established a complete harmony between the soul of man and the soul of the universe. At every step he cries forth, let thy will be done. And you know, there are many ways to characterize Master Kripal, or for, I suppose, any master for that matter. But the characterization that has had most resonance for me over the years, that most truly reflects the experience I have had with the Master, is that obeying a will infinitely above him and yet infinitesimally careful of him. That's the Master I remember. He was infinitely above me, and yet he was infinitesimally careful of me. His love and respect for me, I will never, never forget. It made all the difference in my life. And, you know, it was there from the beginning. I didn't do anything to prove it or to deserve it. Whatever I did, it might be called worthy of deserving something, was after the fact, not before it. It was because of his love and respect for me that whatever he wanted me to do, I was able to do, sort of. Could have been much better, but what can you do? We do our best. The point is that we don't have to measure up. We exist, and that existence is a fact of God. And the Master knows that. As Sanchi said to me, when I asked him if he was displeased with me, he said he was never displeased with any of us because all he saw was our souls. And that's where it was that. But the Master is infinitely above me and infinitesimally careful of me. Thank God. What would the world be like if the Masters didn't come?